came in 65 and spent his entire career here. He retired a year or two after I did, a couple years, I guess.
And this Dick Henson?
Dick Henson, Henson. Richard Henson, H-E-N-S-E-N.
Okay,
S-E-N. And he was sort of my counterpart in transfer admissions. He did. He was coordinator of all the transfer admissions for many, many years.
As you look back, and were there any other colleagues or staff that you worked with closely that,
well,
that really
yeah.
contributed, that you see really contributed? But lots of times, you know, they're below the radar in terms of the official history sometimes, and in oral history we sometimes it's the opportunity to bring in the names of people who, you know, really have made a contribution over the years, whether they're staff members or any that just come to mind. You mentioned some, Gwen Norrell and Dr. Sabine.
Yeah, and of course you've already, I think, dealt with Katie Large in terms of oral history. In terms of local people, I don't know when it could take you back to, there's a Bob Fedor, who was in the office in the 60s. He went on to become associated with one of the medical schools here until he retired. And he's still in town. We have a group that kind of, that goes to lunch about every few months of basically admissions retirees, but some of them are outside the admissions field. Excuse me. But he would be one. I guess Charles Seeley was the most important one in the 70s that I had mentioned. Mm-hmm. The reason I brought him up and what something led me to, he was the person who was the liaison with the athletic department. And all athletic admissions, quote unquote, went through him. When he left, I took that over. So, excuse me, I was responsible for determining the eligibility as freshmen of all entering freshman student athletes. And following, obviously, NCAA and Big Ten guidelines on that, which obviously led to interactions with a lot of people in the athletic department, all the coaches, so I get to know all of them to varying degrees. I don't know that many anymore. There's a few. There's always turnover.
How many years did you do that?
I did that till retired. So Basically 12 years, maybe.
12 years.
Something
okay,
like
right.
that. In that neighborhood, something like that.
What were the big challenges there? In that
I always used to say that 10% of the student-athlete applications took up 90% of my time.
Yeah.
there were... the borderline cases, and the ones, of course, that really were questionable as qualified students whom the coaches desperately wanted to be admitted, and some coaches were had more fervor in that regard than others did, and others were really more on your side than their own. Some were, you know, it was a matter of self-interest as well as success, particularly the more visible sports. The revenue sports in particular. But you just had to deal with a fine-tooth comb in some of them, and some of them had histories you had to go back and trace, and then there were the students who came from foreign countries where you were dealing with foreign credentials, about which I was not an expert, so I had to use colleagues for that, and that helped. But there were some, you know, students who had experiences in more than one secondary school, and you have to track down the original records from all the institutions sometimes before you can certify their eligibility. And
did it help you that you'd been a high school coach?
Probably not. It gave me an appreciation for it. I mean, I felt like I could relate to them because I had done that, but it was pretty minimal. I told Judd Heathcote when I retired, he called me up and said I hadn't asked his permission to retire. I said, Judd, I'm not retiring. I said, my ambition is to be your free throw coach. He had some players at the time who were not good free throw shooters. And I felt I knew how to teach him, but he never offered me.
It sounds like Judd. in looking back at your career at Michigan State, is there anything that just stands out or that you see is maybe most important now that you reflect back?
Well, what was exciting, first of all, it's an exciting university to be in. It was growing, it was changing in the 60s, physically, and it was expanding in terms of students and number of students, quality of students. As an office in the 1960s, we used to compare ourselves to the rent-a-car business. The Avis rent-a-cars motto then was, we're number two, but we try harder. And that's what we said as an admission staff. And Michigan, has always had the prestigious reputation based correctly and logically on their history and tradition. That Michigan State didn't have. Michigan State, being the youngest Big Ten member, had a long ways to go. But that was a terrific challenge. And of course, having the Alumni Distinguished Scholarship Program, the Honors College, the National Merit Scholarship Program, just made it exciting as hell to be doing that. It's not quite that way anymore, but I mean, we even reached the point where we actually traveled on the road to recruit merit semifinals all across the country. Mm-hmm. We had a contract with the Holiday Inn for several years, and we would go to Holiday Inns in 20 states or so, coast to coast, for a week or 2 weeks period of time in the fall, and have meetings for national merit semifinalists and parents. This mm-hmm. is in the 60s and 70s, just for them. Nobody else was invited, mm-hmm. and that was exciting. You took a slideshow and did your sell job. Mm-hmm. And hope to get him back for the ADS program. So that was a highlight, and watching the university grow, and it was just a dynamic place to be. Clearly, John Hanna had a lot to do with that in his years, and it was always interesting that to me that Gordon Sabine, who was the vice president for special projects and therefore oversaw the admissions business, and we all were in awe of him. He was an unbelievable taskmaster, an unbelievably creative idea man. And there are probably only a handful of people at this university that ever appreciated what he did for it. In the history books will never reflect it accurately. The direct and indirect impacts of the things he did here in the 60s, are to us legendary, and this was reflected in some of the remarks at the memorial service. We were, as I said, in some respects in awe of him. He was so demanding, never demanded more of us than he did of himself. But he was in turn in awe of John Hanna. He thought John Hanna walked on water. Mm-hmm. And to have this guy that was just so bright and creative think so highly of his boss and what a person he was. And so he always bowed down to John Hanna. Mm-hmm. So Hanna was the greatest thing that ever happened to this place, obviously. So, and the other thing was the quality of people and the colleagues that I had. And there's still a couple of people over there now that are good friends and were worthy of the being on the kind of staff we had in the 60s and 70s. But that's evidenced by what they did after they left here. Everybody at one time or another left here for something higher up the academic ladder or staff ladder, either if not here, other places. So,
well, I'd like to thank you for your insights and the time that you've spent and for your contributions to the project.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Jeff.